Let me begin by talking about secularists. The subject is how to reach secularists for Christ. And actually, it was a research study done by the Navigators that helped launch the ministry that I'm now directing, Reasons to Believe. This is a research study conducted back in 1986 by some people right here at Navigators headquarters. And they noticed that a certain segment of American society was becoming increasingly difficult to reach with the claims for Christ. And that this population, what they called the secular rationalists, was growing very rapidly. In fact, it's the fastest growing demographic group here in the United States. And so they tried to find out who these people are and why they're so difficult to reach for Christ. And then what can we do as a Christian community to restructure our strategies to effectively penetrate that segment of society with the claims of Jesus Christ? Now, my notes. Here we go. That was all set here. This is the research study, and it's a part of your handout. In fact, it's the lead page of your handout, Recapturing America's Shifting Culture. And you can read all about it. But in their survey work, the Navigators identified five common characteristics of this segment of society called secular rationalists. Namely, that biblical values and spiritual concepts are considered irrelevant and, worse yet, unbelievable by these people. As a result, there's no practical consideration of God in their life. Why would there be if biblical values and concepts are seen as irrelevant and having no basis of factual belief? They have little knowledge of Scripture, and this comes from our survey work. They have little knowledge of Scripture, but they don't think they have little knowledge of Scripture. The surveys that we conducted years ago, we'd ask them the question, have you read the Bible? And you'd get about 90% of people we would talk to door-to-door saying, yes, they've read the entire Bible. But in our follow-up questions, we discerned that if they've read the entire Bible, their memory isn't that great. And so we decided to ask a follow-up question, can you name four books of the Bible? And we discovered that about 90% cannot name four books of the Bible, but their perception is that they're familiar with the Bible. And what's happened is these secular rationalists have been raised in a post-Christian environment, and so, you know, Christianity is part of all that, so they perceive that they're well-educated in these matters, when the truth of the matter is they have very little knowledge of the Scriptures. Church means little or nothing. We're talking about people who've probably never attended church, or the last time they attended church is when they were forced to by their parents growing up. As a result, their philosophy of life is dominated by secular rationalism. This does not mean that they are scientists. It doesn't mean that they would consider themselves rationalists. But what it does mean is that the decisions they make in their life are those that would fall in line with people that take a scientific rationalist view of life. In other words, they have respect for the scientific method. They want to see consistency and logic. And they perceive the Christian faith as violating consistency, logic, and the rules of scientific analysis. And therefore, Christianity means nothing to them. And when people come to them with the claims of Christ, what have they got to teach me? Now, what the Navigator study pointed out is that churches and parachurch organizations have had little or no success in reaching these people. But the optimistic part of this research study was, well, we don't have the tools now, but God is interested in these people. You know, as the Apostle Paul says, not many that are wise by the world standards, but he didn't say not any. And so they concluded that God's desire is that these people be reached for Christ, and what we need to do is shift our tools and shift our strategies. And that's kind of where we came in, because I remember reading this back in 1986 and said, This is exactly what we've been doing for the past several years. And 1986 was the year when the elders in the church that I worked for as Minister of Evangelism said, we want to change your title to Minister of Apologetics. And they're the ones that encouraged me to launch Reasons to Believe. Why? Because our track record had been that we had seen the greatest fruitfulness in terms of people coming to Christ amongst these secular rationalists. We weren't doing so well with nominal Christians, but we were doing far better with these secular rationalists. And the news I want to bring to you today is with the right strategies and the right tools, you'll discover that these secular rationalists are not the most difficult people to lead to Christ, rather the easiest people to lead to Christ. And we've seen phenomenal results. Not all the time, of course. I remember one outreach that we did for hardware and software engineers in the Silicon Valley. 80% of the non-Christians that were in attendance, after hearing a one-hour message, were ready to pray to receive Christ. We've never seen statistics that high amongst nominal Christians, or amongst any other segment of American society, for that matter. Orange County once, we had an outreach. And see, these secular rationalists like to hang out with people that are like themselves. And so we designed an outreach for medical doctors that had PhDs in some other field of research science. And only in Orange County would you find 75 of them living all there. But about two-thirds of the non-Christians that were present that night also were ready to receive Christ. And so it shows you that there can be great fruitfulness if you put together the right setting and you use the right tools. And you don't have to be a PhD in astrophysics to make it work. People don't believe me when I say that, or after they've heard my talk. But the proof of the pudding is this. In our Ministry of Reasons to Believe, we run a hotline. In fact, if you don't get to ask your question today, we got a card there for you that you can fill out, and then you can just write down your question, or you can phone. Every day, we have this hotline that runs for 2 hours, and it's staffed by volunteers. None of them research scientists. They've simply been through our courses. We put them on the phones, and they deal with all the skeptics, atheists, nominal Christians, secularists that come in, and they're doing very well. I thank God for our volunteer apologists. I also thank God for their testimony. These are people who don't have extensive training in theology or science, but they've learned something. Secular rationalists have about a couple of dozen burning issues on their heart. And if you can equip yourself to deal with those couple of dozen issues, you're covered. And then there's the obscure questions, which add up to about 200. And so if you've been through all 200 questions, you're really covered. But the couple of dozen really does take care of it for about 95% of the cases that take place. So I'm not going to be able to give you everything so that you can run our hotline by 4 o'clock. But what I hope to give you is the hope that if you begin to immerse yourself in these tools, you too can be equipped to bring these secular rationalists to faith in Christ with similar percentages, at least in certain environments. I'm the first to admit sometimes only 20% respond. But it's phenomenal, the fruitfulness that you do see. And also you'll notice there are two kinds of secular rationalists. There are those who their primary barrier is intellectual. I'd be more than willing to accept this Christian message if only I could see some factual basis in it all. There are others who have a more personal reason for rejecting Christ. They're committed to a moral lifestyle counter to the gospel. But the face they show up to their friends is, I can't accept Christianity because of all the inconsistencies with the facts that I know to be true out there in the secular realm. It's a smokescreen. But you can never find out what that personal reason is and then deal with it at a personal, compassionate level until you cut through the smokescreen. And I've seen that happen on several occasions. Talking to university professors, for example. At the end of the talk, hey, we know this stuff you're saying is true, but we're not prepared to receive. And in admitting that, they begin to share their real reasons for rejecting the gospel, reasons they would have never exposed unless that intellectual fog had been cut through, where they had to accept the fact that this is factual. Okay, now I'm willing to deal with the heart issues and not just the mind issues. Well, I want to encourage you with this too. It's absolutely essential that we Christians begin to deal with the secular rationalists. Because what the navigators discovered in their 1986 research report is that secular rationalists here in the States accounted for 40% of the population. That was a shock. Because, you know, the perception of many people in the Christian community, sure, there's secular rationalists out there at the 5 to 10% level. And that's what it was a generation ago. How did this group of people run from 5 to 10% of the population to 40% of the population in just one generation? How did they get that far out of control? And they nailed the reason. The church ignored them. The parachurch organizations ignored them. They were terrified of them, and so they just shied away. And you do that, that segment is bound to grow. And that's what's happened. I'm from Canada. Canada is a country that was dominated by the Christian culture 150 years ago. Today, it's not 40% secular rationalists, it's 85%. They're about a generation ahead of what's going on here in the United States. In other words, if we ignore it for another generation, that 40% will become 85%. Worst case example I can think of is a country of Japan, 99.5% secular rationalists. You know, why has that country been so impervious to the message of Jesus Christ with all the missionaries and all the opportunities? It's that secular rationalism for which the mission agencies typically operating there are ill-equipped to deal with. So what I'd like to do is suggest a path whereby we can turn those numbers around and go from 99% down to 85, down to 40, back down to 10. How can we do that? Moreover, the other thing that encourages me most is when you bring secular rationalists to faith in Christ, particularly those who don't have a moral barrier, it's like they're immediately equipped to take leadership roles in our church. They tend to be our most productive disciplers. And it's kind of like the ministry of the Apostle Paul. He went after the leaders first, because through the leaders he could reach so many others. And then the leaders are often are more ready to get equipped so they become productive and fruitful. So let's go for it. And what I'd like to do is first begin by sharing with you an example of how a secular rationalist came to Christ. I was a secular rationalist, so I'm going to give myself as an example. And born and raised in Canada, I did not meet a Christian to get to know a Christian until I was 27 years old. That would never happen here in the States because there's only 40% secular rationalists. But in a nation that's 85%, and you want to know where those other 15% are? 15% that have had some exposure to the Christian faith? They live in the rural parts of Canada and in suburbs distant to the city cores. Where did I grow up? Downtown Montreal, downtown Vancouver, downtown Toronto. That's where I lived all my life. And there you're dealing with 99% secular rationalists. And so it's easy to live 27 years without ever meeting one of these evangelical Christians. And that's what happened to me. And the way my mother tells it, she says I was born a rationalist, that I was literally born a scientist. I started asking questions as soon as I learned how to talk, which was 5 years of age. And by age 7, yeah, it took me a long time to learn how to talk, because I've been trained not to. That's a whole other story. But when I finally did begin, that was kind of the first questions out of my mouth. You know, what about various aspects of the world of nature? By age 7, I became fascinated with astronomy, and I began to spend time in the library reading everything I could find on astronomy and physics. And at age 8, I knew that was going to be my future career, astrophysics. And that wasn't unusual. Lots of kids in our neighborhood were doing the same thing. That's typical in a place where it rains incessantly. I mean, I remember reading about the Genesis flood, and my first response is only 40 days and 40 nights. I've been through several winters where it rained at least twice that long, nonstop. So it is conducive to intellectual activities. But it was my astronomy that led me to faith in God. I didn't believe God existed growing up. That was kind of the predominant view of the schools and the neighborhood in which I grew up. But by age 15 and a half, I learned enough about the origin of the universe to realize that the Big Bang model was the correct description for the universe. And if the universe is exploding according to a Big Bang, then I knew there had to be a beginning. And if there's a beginning, there had to be a beginner, hence the existence of God. So from the age of 15 and a half onwards, I did not deny the existence of God. But I denied the idea that God was personal, because I felt a God that created 100 billion trillion stars certainly has got more things to do than to be worried about events on this insignificant speck of dust we call planet Earth. And so I remember going into a high school class, grade 12, where we were studying for about a couple of weeks comparative religions. I was part of the public education system up there in Canada. And I was very skeptical about this claim that God was communicating through written writings, through holy books. But I felt that out of intellectual honesty's sake, I should at least go through a rudimentary exercise and demonstrate to myself that indeed God is not communicating and these so-called holy books are humanly crafted frauds. And I had a long background in science, even at that age, and so I used the principles of scientific investigation, which is you do the easy things first and save the most difficult to the end, which means you start with the Hindu Vedas. And it only took a few hours for me to discover that the Vedas were filled with scientific absurdities. And see, that was my yardstick. I said, the God that I see in the world of nature is a God that appreciates simplicity, beauty, elegance, harmony. There are no contradictions. God is not capricious. And I said, if God is communicating to us through a holy book, we're going to see that those same aspects of simplicity, elegance, beauty, harmony, consistency. And that's what I looked for, was lack of harmony. I looked for contradictions. I looked for errors. In the case of the Hindu Vedas, they were loaded. I mean, it starts talking about human civilizations and cities on the surface of the sun. I just chuckled to myself and said, well, I guess the Hindu theologians of 3,000 years ago weren't aware of how warm it is on the surface of the sun. And they talked about the universe being eternal and time being eternal. And even back in the early 60s, we had lots of evidence to show that wasn't true. And so I said, forget that. The dominant faith in our neighborhood, besides secular rationalism, was Buddhism, because Chinatown wasn't too far away. I was eager to get into that, but quickly discovered that Buddhist theology borrows heavily from Hindu theology. In fact, all their cosmology is identical to Hinduism. And so if that's the case, there's no truth in Buddhism. And then I quickly moved from there into Islam, checked out the Quran. When I got into the Quran, I discovered a common denominator. I said, all these holy books have something in common. They're vague. And I would say the Quran is the vaguest of the lot. I mean, you've got to read pages and pages and pages of this stuff just to find something specifically enough stated that you know what it's talking about. The other thing I noticed that was a common denominator was esotericism. There was this air of intellectual mystery, kind of along, if you're one of the great enlightened ones, you'll understand the message of these writing. Otherwise, forget it. And I said, that's not the God I see in nature. In nature, everything is out in the open, ready for investigation. There isn't this attempt to hide. There isn't this appeal to intellectual snobbery. And so that concerned me. But because of the vague language of the Quran, it took me a lot longer than it did the other holy books to find contradictions and errors. But for example, I found a verse that says that the stars are closer to us than the planets. And we know that's not true. Also places frequently historical events in the wrong geographical locations. And so I said, that's not the God I see in nature either. And I went through a few more holy books, like the Mormon texts, and discovered it was filled with predictions about the future that did not come true. And I said, I don't see that in nature. The God of nature doesn't make mistakes. And then finally I got to the Bible. And when I told you I didn't get to know a Christian until age 27, that's not entirely true. I got to see two Christians from 40 feet away when I was 11 years old. They were two businessmen that came into our school, and they didn't say a word. They just had a big box. And they opened the box, and the box was filled with these Gideon Bibles. And we each took one. And my Gideon Bible went unread for 6 years. But at age 17, I finally took it off the shelf and began to go through it. And the first thing that struck me is this isn't vague, and it's not esoteric poetry. It's clear and direct. The language is radically different. But I also noticed that the Gideons only gave me the New Testament Psalms and Proverbs. I always like to start on page one, so that's what I did. I got myself an Old Testament, saw this account of creation. By this time, I'd been through a couple of dozen creation stories, and I was ready to laugh again. We call them creation myths. And I heard that the Bible's account also was a myth, and so I was eager to check that out. But was startled to discover that it wasn't mythological at all. In fact, the thing that struck me right away is that it followed the scientific method. Now, I have to confess I was naive at age 17. I didn't know why the Bible followed the scientific method. 10 years later, when I read the writings of Thomas Torrance, the Scottish theologian, I discovered why Genesis follows the scientific method. The scientific method was derived from the Bible, so of course the Bible follows the scientific method. That's where it came from. But I didn't know that. But I was very much impressed by the scientific method. So the fact that the Bible followed that was most encouraging. And how do you see it? What's the first step in the scientific method? You identify the frame of reference of the point of view. And that's how Genesis starts off. The Spirit of God was brooding over the surface of the waters. That's the viewpoint from which we're to understand the account. And what's the second step of the scientific method? You identify the initial conditions. What's the second half of that verse say? The Spirit of God was brooding over the surface of the waters and was dark on the surface of the waters, and the earth was formless and void. In other words, it was empty of life and unfit for life. And fortunately, I had enough astrophysics under my belt at that time to realize those indeed are the three initial conditions of planet Earth. All planets start off that way. It wasn't that God created light on the first day, as that light appeared for the first time to the observer on the surface of the waters on the first day. I didn't know anything about the Hebrew. Years later, I discovered that that's exactly what the Hebrew supports. Now, the light was made in the beginning, but it shows up on the first day. And with my astrophysics, I understood that, yes, all planets begin with atmospheres that are opaque to light. And so God transformed the atmosphere. On the fourth day, He transformed it again. So it went from translucency to transparency, and now you can see the sun, moon, and stars. Well, what the scientific method tells you is don't even attempt to interpret the sequence of events until you first establish the point of view and the initial condition. Step three is then you begin to interpret the sequence of events. The fourth thing you want to do is look for a concluding statement. And all that's there in Genesis 1. And by the time I went through all the details of Genesis 1, I recognized that the three initial conditions and the 11 events of creation were all correctly stated and in the correct chronological order. Then I did a back of an envelope calculation of what are the odds that someone writing 3,500 years ago could have placed the events in the right order if he had been given the right events to start with. One chance in 6 billion. You can check it out. It's 14 factorial. That's 14 times 13 times 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, down to 3, 2, 1. You can work it out if you get bored during my talk. But the most amazing thing of all, of course, is not that the events were placed in the right order, but that they were correctly described. The other thing that struck me is by the time I got through that first evening study of the Bible, I realized I'd spent almost 3 hours in just the first chapter. And I found more in chapter one to put to the test than I found in any other entire holy book. and said, this is a God like the one I see in nature. Everything's out for investigation. We don't have to search. I mean, in Genesis 1 alone, there's over 30 specific statements about the record of nature that can be put to the test and stated in very specific terms. And says, this is a God that sticks his neck out. And so that night I made a commitment that I would spend a minimum of 1 hour a day studying the Bible until I found a single provable error or contradiction. Now I figured that would probably keep me busy 5 or 6 weeks. It kept me busy for 18 months. And that's how long it took me to get to Revelation 22. Because there was so much that could be checked. And by the time I got to Revelation 22, I had to admit to myself that I had failed to find a single provable error or contradiction. Now, I will say this. After those 18 months, I found lots of passages in this book that I didn't understand. But that didn't bother me because that was also true of the record of nature. There was plenty there I didn't understand. I also found problems in this book I couldn't solve. But I said, that's also true of the record of nature. There's problems there I can't solve either. But what amazed me most of all is how much of it I did understand and how thoroughly it demonstrated itself to be a perfect fit with the established facts of science and history, geography, etc. But then I looked around at the University of British Columbia. That was the campus where I was studying physics. And it was a campus that at that time was famous for its mockery of belief in God, and particularly of evangelical Christianity. And after 18 months, I knew that if I were to become a Christian, it couldn't be a private faith anymore. I would have to tell others. And I was concerned about the mockery and the ridicule that I would face. And so rather than becoming a Christian, I went through the whole Bible a second time, saying, okay, I can't find any errors, but if I'm going to stick my neck out, I need some positive evidences. And so I spent the next several months developing such evidences. And some of these are handouts. One that you'll find in your collection there is this one called Biblical Forecasts of Scientific Discoveries. And what I was doing here was calculating odds kind of like I was doing in Genesis chapter 1. I said, one chance in 6 billion that the order is right. But I found several other places in the Bible where I could make a similar calculation. Like, what are the odds that Job would have happened to identify those star clusters whose stars are bound to one another and leave everything else out? You can work that out. Just add up all the star clusters, 2 divided by that number, and you got that probability. Is that handout not in there? Okay, it was supposed to be. Tell you what, it's this one, Biblical Forecasts of Scientific Discoveries. Call or write us. We'll send it to you at no charge. And that probably means that this handout on the historical evidences didn't make it either. Fulfilled prophecy, evidence for the reliability of the Bible. But we'll offer that free of charge to you as well. I think what is in your handout is this one. Did you get this one? It's just a one-page summary of my personal testimony. Okay, that made it. But if you want the supporting evidences that go with it, that's not there either? Oh, gee. That's the second. It is in there. They tell me it's in there. Okay. At least we got something in there. Anyway, we'll be happy to make that available to you. And now what these two little tools are designed to do is to enable you on your own to come up with a mathematical proof for the reliability of the scriptures. And like what we've done with the science is just to take 1 chance in 6 billion times 1 chance in 100 for the star clusters times 1 chance in whatever you care to estimate for the Bible getting the correct numbers of stars in the universe, the correct descriptions of the first and second laws of thermodynamics, etc. These are independent events, so if you want the odds that they're all correctly stated, you have to multiply them together and you get a fantastic number. Something that's a little easier to do for those of you that don't have an engineering or a science background is to do the same thing with our historical evidences. Because what I notice at age 19 is that all holy books try to establish their supernaturality by predicting the future. And the best I'd found outside of the Bible were the three books that the Mormon faith has developed to add to the Old and New Testament. They make about 50 predictions about the future, which is the record outside of the Bible. And it's 40% right, 60% wrong. Rather amazing they get 40% right. On the other hand, they're only predicting events like 10, 20 years in the future. So that discounts a little bit. But when you come to the Bible, 3,500 times it predicts the future. 3,000 of those have been fulfilled. And it's a 1,000 batting score. There are no errors. Moreover, the Bible, unlike these other holy books, is far more specific in its predictions. It even goes so far as to give people's names before they're born to say what they will do, where they will do it, and when they will do it. You know, that really is sticking your neck out, to predict somebody by name even before they're born. And we give you some examples of this, and we even show you how to work out the probabilities for yourself. It really isn't difficult. Let me give you an example. The Bible predicted that there would be a future king of the Medes and Persians, and that his name would be Cyrus. The prophet Isaiah made those predictions. He made the prediction before the Medes and Persians even existed as a people. He made the prediction 80 years before Cyrus was born. And then he predicted that this king Cyrus would conquer Babylon, another non-existent kingdom, and in conquering Babylon would set free all the Jewish slaves, and not only set them free, but give them money to rebuild their kingdom, their city, their temple, and that he would finance the religious services, and yet he wouldn't be a believer in God. Jeremiah added one more detail. He will do this in exactly the 70th year of your captivity. Now, what are the odds that would happen to come true coincidentally? What are the odds you would get the name right? Well, 80 years from now, or from thence, how many names could such a king possibly take? You take one and you divide by the total number of possible names. What are the odds you would get the year right? Well, how many years could such an event possibly be fulfilled in human history? You take that total number of years and it's one divided by the total number of years. Now, what are the odds you would get both the name right and the year right? Independent events. They're not related to one another. Which means to get the probability for both, you multiply both probabilities together. And you work your way step by step down through all the other details. Now, the numbers I put on here were numbers that were calculated not by me, but by my research science friends at the University of Toronto and Caltech, all of them unbelievers. The most conservative number I got for that particular set of predictions was that the odds that it was a coincidence would be less than one chance in 10 trillion. Now, that's one. We give you 12 more in this handout. There's another instance where the Bible makes a set of predictions about a king that was born 300 years later. And it was prophesied his name would be Josiah, and all the details are given about exactly what this king Josiah would do, how he would invade the northern kingdom of Israel without an army. And in this invasion, he would uncover these bones of 400 false prophets that died 300 years earlier and burn their bones to lime on an altar. Then we show you how to calculate that possibility. Again, the most conservative number I got from these research scientist friends of mine, one chance in 1 trillion. So what are the odds that the Bible would be coincidentally correct both on King Josiah and on King Cyrus? Independent events. That's one chance in a trillion times one chance in 10 trillion, or one chance in 10 trillion trillion. And when you get through all 13, it's one chance in 10 of the 138. That's 138 zeros after the one. Now, this was a coincidence. The very time I came up with that number of one chance in 10 of the 138 was when I was given an assignment in the physics class to calculate the possibility that the second law of thermodynamics would reverse. Instead of heat flowing from hot bodies to cold bodies, it would go from cold bodies to hot bodies. And there's a very small chance that will happen. And we had to calculate that as a problem assignment. And let me kind of give you a layman's description of that. Take this auditorium, for example. In this auditorium, there are quadrillions of air molecules. They're not all the same temperature. Some are hot, some are cold, but you average it all out, it's room temperature. But there's a statistical chance that the trillions of air molecules that are in this room that are below the freezing point of water in the next second will wander in the vicinity of where you're sitting and freeze you to death. And we need to calculate that possibility. It's one chance in 10 to the 80th. Now, that possibility is so tiny that I don't think any of you loses any sleep about a possible reversal. You just don't worry about it because it's just not going to happen. In fact, in physics, we say if anything is less than one chance in 10 to the 50th of happening, we can call that an impossible event. In fact, in physics, we can't prove anything is impossible. We can only prove that things are nearly impossible, which is an interesting point, by the way. If the atheist says, I want absolute proof for the existence of God, I cannot meet his demand. But if he's willing to accept evidence for the existence of God, that's as secure as the evidence that I'm speaking to him, that we can do. And that's what we call practical evidence. It's really good enough, because that's how we make the rest of our decisions in our life. But what I'd realized as a young man, I had just demonstrated that this book, based on only 13 fulfilled prophecies, was 10 to the 58 times more reliable than the second law of thermodynamics. Therefore, it would not be rational for me as a young man to put my trust in the second law of thermodynamics. And literally, when you think about it, we're gambling our life every second on the reliability of that law of thermodynamics. It would be irrational for me to trust that law and not to trust something that I had just proven itself to be far more reliable. But I didn't do it. It took me 3 more months. You know why? I was still frightened about that mockery and ridicule. So for 3 months I hesitated. And the reason my hesitation stopped is that those were the first 3 months of my life when my grades began to go downhill. And it wasn't a radical decline. It was a nice slow decline that I had all graphed out in a piece of graph paper. And I could see my physics test scores gradually slipping. And I tried to reverse the trend with hard work, and it wasn't working. And I kept asking myself, how come I can't reverse this trend? 3 months later, as I continued to read in the Bible, I found a few verses. You'll find them in John chapter 3 and Romans chapter 1. When a man rejects what he is convinced is true about God and yet will not submit to it, his mind becomes darkened and confused. And I realized that night I was that man. But I also was so stunned by that revelation, I said, I'm not going to let this night pass by until I decide one way or the other. So I asked God to make me a Christian. And I prayed that prayer hour after hour with no results. At 1 o'clock in the morning, that same night, as I kept reading this book, I found out where I made my error. In the Gospels, Jesus consistently reveals himself to be a gentleman. He's gentle and respectful. And how frequently people in the Gospels made the same demand I was. God, if you want me as one of yours, you've got to do it. You have to make me a Christian. And I saw the wrong attitude. I was asking Jesus to force himself upon me, and that was counter to his character. And thank God for the Gideons. They tell you exactly what to do. Last 2 pages of every one of their Gideon Bibles. So I turned to that and read it over. And it talks about recognizing that you fall short of the glory of God. And it says, that's easy. I've been trying to live up to my own standards as I see in the conscience that God has given me. And I can't make my own standards, let alone God's. And I realized that was God's tool for telling me that I'm not perfect, but that he demands perfection. He doesn't grade in a curve. The more you try to live up to it, the stronger your conscience acts. So I told God I wasn't perfect and that I needed that perfection. And then I thanked him for his gift through Jesus Christ, who led a perfect life and yet in that perfection took upon himself the penalty for my imperfection. And thanks to the Gideons, I realize it doesn't take effect until you ask for it. It's a gift, but you have to receive it. I said, right now, I receive that gift. And I also recognize that I didn't know what was best for myself. I'm not perfect. Therefore, I'm not really the one to be in charge of my life. And that's when I turned the control of my life over to Jesus Christ and said, you take over. And what I admire, too, about the Gideons, they don't let you off the hook. They got a place there for you to sign your name and date it, making your commitment in ink. And so I did that. And that settled it to such a degree that the next day I was looking forward to share my new faith in Jesus Christ. Because I'd been doing all this in secret for 2 years. I didn't tell anyone. And so I picked my lab partner and said, I'm going to talk to him. And I learned something profound. God's in the business of making it easier for those that are committed to his purpose. That's a paraphrase of Romans 8 and several other verses. But I had a chance to see that experientially. Because when I met my lab partner, I had it all prepared exactly what I was going to say. And he stopped me and says, Hugh, don't talk. I got to talk. He says, I've been going through problems I haven't shared with anyone, not even you. I need to talk to somebody. I need to talk to somebody about God. Do you know anybody in this campus that knows anything about God? So, what better opportunity? And see, I could share several stories like that of encounters I've had with scientists, students, and professors. But there came a day at Caltech when I met another astronomer who had been raised in a Christian home. I wasn't, he was. He says, Hugh, I've been watching you. You're spending all your time sharing your Christian faith with scientists. Have you ever thought about sharing with non-scientists? I says, sure, Dave, but where do you meet these non-scientists? And he assured me that if I left the Caltech campus, that I would find a few. But what he was trying to get through to me was this. The typical scientist struggles with the will, not the mind. The typical non-scientist struggles with the mind and not the will. So the vast majority of secular rationalists out there, they simply need to know that there's evidence. That's the struggle of the mind. Whereas the people I've been talking to at the University of Toronto and Caltech, there are people who you'd sit down with for an hour and a half, and they wouldn't fight you on the existence of God or the utter inerrancy of the Bible. But they weren't ready to submit their will. That was another 1, 2, 3, 4 years it would take for them to make that move, and I thought that was normal. It took me 2 years. Surely that's the industry standard. But when I began to talk to non-scientists, in fact, the first fellow I talked to, I just went door to door. I mean, I didn't know any other way to meet these non-scientists other than to go door to door. And the first guy I talked to, I gave him 10 minutes worth of evidence, and he says, stop, I don't want to hear anymore. I says, no problem. I'll go talk to your neighbor. Have a good day. He says, look, I don't want you to leave. He says, I'm convinced. You need to tell me what I need to do with my life. He was ready to pray to receive Christ. I was ready to give him another hour's worth of evidence. So Dave Rogstad was right. That's where they struggle, the level of the mind, not the will. But I see this as a blessed generation in the sense that I can't think of another generation that has seen such evidence of pride as this generation. You know, in that sense, I think it was typical. I was a proud young man and ahead with overwhelming evidence to get my attention. And I think that's rather typical of the world in which we live. We have more money, we have more education, we have more technology, we have more personal freedom than any other generation has ever possessed. And what have we done with that? We've taken credit for it, and that has led to incredible pride. But how is God breaking through? Overwhelming evidence. No generation has seen the evidence that this generation has. And what really launched our ministry of Reasons to Believe was a series of discoveries made in 1985, where we recognize that through those discoveries, the universe had been measured for the first time in human history. Now, what's so significant about that? Well, if you can measure the universe, you're measuring the creation. And if you're measuring the creation, then you have a scientific tool for determining several characteristics of the Creator. And that's the story I want to tell you, is what characteristics have been proven through the scientific evidences, and exactly where does that lead us, and how can we possibly equip ourselves to use this new tool that God has placed uniquely in the hands of this generation. That was 1985. This is 1993. Did you know that 1992 was called by my peers in astronomy the greatest year in cosmology? Because more discoveries were made in 1992 pertaining to the origin of the universe and the creation event than any other year in the history of astrophysics. And maybe you heard about it. April 23rd, 1992, there was a discovery that was published in every newspaper around the world. It made every television newscast in the world. In the words of Carlos Frank, who is an older cosmologist at the University of Durham, he says, "This discovery is the most exciting thing that's happened in my life as a cosmologist." Stephen Hawking, he's a fellow in a wheelchair who wrote the book A Brief History of Time, and it's just been released as a movie, and he's touted as being the most brilliant physicist in the world. He calls this the greatest discovery of the century, if not of all time. And what's remarkable about this statement coming from Stephen Hawking is he has a reputation for understatement. This doesn't sound like an understated comment. Michael Turner, University of Chicago astrophysicist, said the significance of this discovery cannot be overstated. They have found the holy grail of cosmology. Now, how holy of a grail are we talking about? Well, the fellow who led the 30 physicists that made the discovery, George Smoot of the University of California, Berkeley, he said, "What we have found is evidence for the birth of the universe. It's like looking at God." Other times he said, "We're seeing the face of God like we've never seen it before." Frederick Burnham, who is a science historian, made the comment that the idea that God created the universe is a more respectable hypothesis today because of this discovery than at any time in the last 100 years. And my favorite quote of all is from an atheist astronomer, Jeffrey Burbidge. He says of his peers in astronomy, all of us who are astronomers and physicists, that we have rushed off to join the First Church of Christ of the Big Bang. And his first response to the discovery is, it can't possibly be true, because if it is true, it leads to unacceptable theological conclusions. Jeffrey Burbidge. And last week I made the comment, this is my second time here, when I said to the group, this field of new developments that are proving the existence of God, and not just God, but the God of the Bible, is so fertile that literally every month, there's some new piece of evidence that strengthens the case. And I made an understatement, because between last Friday and this Friday, another discovery's been made, which really nails Jeffrey Burbidge's statement. He says, "Oh, well, that COBE satellite discovery, it's just noise, it's not real. But a balloon experiment just announced this past week has demonstrated that everything that these scientists claim from the COBE satellite experiment is true. A balloon experiment saw exactly the same stuff." And so, Jeffrey Burbidge, you can pretend it's not there, but it's like putting your head in the sand. This discovery is real, and we have to face up to the theological conclusions that it brings. Now, what I'm going to do is simply list for you 6 discoveries. Because what was announced to the newspapers was one discovery. What you saw Ted Koppel discuss on Nightline was just one discovery. Oh, and by the way, let me say a little bit about how Ted Koppel handled it. He gave us 40 minutes of his Nightline program. He has never given that much time to anything scientific before. But he was personally so fascinated by the implications that he interviewed 2 physicists. And he starts the interview off by quoting Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. And he quoted it verbatim. I was impressed with that. But I was more impressed with the fact that after he quoted those first 2 verses, he turned to the physicist on his right, and the physicist said, "Well, you know, Ted, we can't stop there. We have to quote the 3rd verse too." And he quoted the verse verbatim. And the rest of the 40 minutes was discussing how these new discoveries fit in with the first 3 verses of Genesis. What was not revealed to the layman is that the reason the astrophysicists were so excited was that this one discovery was made in the context with 5 other discoveries. And now 6 discoveries, 7 discoveries altogether, thanks to what's happened this past week. And all these discoveries are like the remaining pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. We were seeing the face of God before, as far back as 1985, but we couldn't see the face clearly. It's kind of like having a 100-piece jigsaw puzzle, and you're missing the last 7 pieces. and the last seven pieces happen to be right in the facial area of the portrait. And so you can tell a person's there. You can tell a face is there, but you can't make a real definite identification. And that's kind of the way it was with my peers. They knew God existed. They knew it was the God of the Bible. But thanks to these seven discoveries, things became much sharper and focused. It's like putting in those last seven pieces, and now you can say, oh yes, there is the shape of the ear and the nose, etc. And I think that was the result of that comment. It's like seeing the face of God before we saw him, but now we're actually looking at his face. That was the basis of the comment. And see, these seven discoveries are all cooperative. They're all saying the same thing. And that's what got my peers so excited. Now, this is a little bit technical, and I'm not going to give you the technicalities. If you want them, we got them for you. You can get our newsletter, and incidentally, this is free of charge, and there's a little card there you can fill out where you can get this free of charge. You can subscribe to it. This comes out every 3 months, and it keeps you up to date on the latest discoveries that add to the evidence for the God of the Bible. But we've reprinted this one. In fact, we've distributed over 10,000 copies since it was first printed. And you can get this. And it's a four-page article on the theological significance of this set of six discoveries. Now, we've also put it in an audio tape form. And this was given to our staff. They said, could you put together a nice layman's audio tape message? And I said, sure, I can do that if you give me 65 minutes. And they gave me 65 minutes. So if you like a nice layman's description to go with the newsletter article also designed for the layman, that's available. But I don't have that kind of time here today. And so I'm just going to give you a list. The April 23rd discovery is they found fluctuations in the cosmic background radiation. You know, when we talk about the universe being a Big Bang, what we really mean is it's kind of like an oven. Now, you know, most of you have been in a kitchen once or twice, and you have that oven on, and it gets real hot. Then you open the oven door, what happens? The cavity of the oven cools because the molecules inside that oven expand outward. And see, what astronomers have been doing is they've been taking very sensitive thermometers and placing them all around, measuring the heat from the creation event. Now, the creation event is like that very hot oven. And what we're simply doing is measuring how much time has gone on since the door was opened and then how hot it was. You say, how can they do all that? Hey, you take a bunch of thermometers, say in front of your kitchen oven, and if those thermometers all give you the identical temperature to many places of the decimal, that tells you that the oven was extremely hot when the door was opened. Why? Because in order to get that identical temperature everywhere, that means the heat flow from the oven must dominate all other air flows in the kitchen. And the only way that could be true is if the oven was extremely hot in the beginning. And that's why we talk about the hot Big Bang, because the thermometers are all giving the same temperature. Now, what they discovered were fluctuations in that temperature that would explain how galaxies form. Because matter has the property that it strongly interacts with radiation. And so if the radiation is smooth, then the matter must be smooth. But we live in a galaxy. That's evidence that the universe does not smoothly distribute its matter. The universe is clumped. And so in order to get the clumping of the universe, you need to have at least a little bit of fluctuation in that radiation. And so that's what they sent this satellite up to look for. But they already were aware that the universe was so smooth in its radiation that the only way to explain the clumpiness of the galaxies was that there was another kind of matter. Not just the matter that we're made up of, protons and neutrons, that strongly interacts with radiation, but exotic matter that does not strongly interact with radiation. Nobody had seen exotic matter until 4 months ago. We've now seen it. But, you know, a year ago it was just pure speculation. Speculation based on the fact that there are galaxies in the universe. If there are galaxies, there must be this other kind of matter. And they said, if there is this kind of matter, we should see fluctuations of about one part in 100,000 of this cosmic background radiation. That's exactly what the COBE satellite revealed on April 23rd, the very amount that the theoreticians have predicted. But there's more to the story than that. The observers came in, and for the first time, they gave us an accurate measure of the quantity of ordinary matter in the universe and the quantity of exotic matter in the universe. That was detected for the first time just this past August. And then we had two different ways of measuring the total amount of matter in the universe. So what do you got here? Five independent tools for measuring the ratio of exotic matter to ordinary matter in the universe. They all gave the same answer. And what that did for the community of astronomers is it took them from confidence in the Big Bang model to confidence in a tiny subset of the Big Bang model. Now, here's the way science operates. I remember when I was at Caltech, I ran into this very famous astronomer, and he says, "Hugh, come into my office." And when I was in his office, he says, "Close the door." So I closed the door. He says, "I want to tell you, I admire what you're doing, sharing your Christian faith with all the rest of the guys here." He says, "I bet you didn't know this, but I go to church. I read and study my Bible, I pray, etc. And I think what you're doing is fantastic. And incidentally, don't tell anybody about this conversation." Now, it's so typical of my peers. How many of them were theists, or at least deists, but they were not willing to go public. Even Robert Jastrow wrote the book God and the Astronomers. He says in that book he's an agnostic. No way. No one could write that book and be an agnostic. But the reason he didn't want to come out and say that he was a believer in the God of the Bible is that people would ask him the next question. Well, if you believe this, how come your life doesn't demonstrate the characteristics of one who follows God? If you don't want to handle that, or if you don't want to deal with, well, you know, if you're a Christian, I got a bunch of questions I want to ask you about science and the Bible. That's really the reason why a lot of my peers hang back. But the hanging back has stopped. You can see the quotes. For the first time, these scientists are going public and saying, "We're seeing God." They weren't willing to do that a year ago. And the way scientists operate, I think I'm typical here too. Your typical scientist is shy and introverted and very conservative. In fact, when I was interviewed at the University of British Columbia as a freshman student, they said, "Hugh, you'll be a success at anything you choose to do as long as it doesn't involve people or talking." So, and you know, how do I do what I do now? Well, I suffered the first 600 or 700 times. And, you know, those first 600 times, it was really tough. If it wasn't for the fact that I was convinced that God wanted me to share this news with others, I would never do it. That's just not my personality. But when scientists become convinced of a specific subset of a particular model, then they're willing to go public with their commitment to the general description. It's the Big Bang description of the universe according to the laws of general relativity that established the God of the Bible. But many of my peers weren't willing to say so until this year, because now we know far more than that. We're not just talking evidence for a Big Bang. We're talking about evidence for a particular subset of the Big Bang. And if we've got that kind of evidence, then there's no basis at all for doubting the general model. So that's just kind of how science operates and explains what's going on. But I want to spend the remainder of my time dealing with the general, not the particular. You want to pursue the particular? You can go ahead and get our video or our books, or you can get this tape, or subscribe to Facts and Faith. But let me give you the general stuff. Now, secular rationalism was fostered out of Western Europe. One man I think deserves a lot of credit for it is Immanuel Kant. He is the father of agnosticism. He's also the father of cosmology. And his agnosticism flows out of his cosmology. The first book he wrote was a book on cosmology. In that book he said the following: God is infinite. But if God is infinite, then the universe must be infinite, because nothing less than an infinite universe would befit an infinite creator. Then he let that sit for 30 years, and he switched from doing physics and astronomy to doing philosophy. Now, what did he say in his Critique of Pure Reason? Lots of people have read that. Very few people have read his Theory of the Heavens, which he wrote in his 20s. But what he said in Critique of Pure Reason is the following. If the universe is infinite, we know it's infinite, then that means that it's possible to throw the dice of chance an infinite number of times in an infinite variety of ways. And sure, we recognize it's not very easy to assemble a German philosopher by natural processes. But if you've got an infinite number of throws of the dice of chance, even that would become a possibility. Sooner or later, it would happen. And see, that's worldview literally comes right down to 1993. Now, that's what's behind a lot of this secular rationalism. But the fellow who challenged that, Albert Einstein, and he did it through something incredibly beautiful, something more beautiful than any of you have ever seen before in your life. I'd like to share with you the most beautiful thing in all of God's creation. Equations of physics. What can possibly transcend the beauty of equations of physics? But seriously, I wanted you to see the equation that proved to Albert Einstein that God must exist. And I can see sweat breaking out in some of your foreheads right now, wondering what the rest of the seminar is going to be like. This will be gone in about 30 seconds. You'll never see another equation for the rest of my talk, so you can relax. But for those of you that are engineers in the audience, and I see a few of you nodding your heads, what you have here is calculus notation for acceleration. Einstein literally derived through his equations of general relativity an expression for the acceleration of the whole universe. Now, what you have on the other side of the equation are physical constants. The constant that governs the force of gravity, the constant that measures the mass of the universe and the pressure of the universe, and this is the velocity of light. Now, you don't have to worry your little heads about that. All you need to understand is that they all have positive values. And if they all have positive values, there's a minus sign out here. What does that tell you? Immanuel Kant is wrong when he said the universe was static for infinite time, presenting the same picture forever as it does right now, meaning we can keep throwing the dice of chance without ever stopping. What did Albert Einstein discover? It's not static. It's experiencing negative acceleration. Now, Einstein was not just a good mathematician. He knew quite a bit about the astronomy. He knew that in the universe, the pressure term, this P, is very, very tiny compared to the density term. And as you can see, it's divided by a huge number, the velocity of light squared, which means that for all practical purposes, you can ignore the 3P divided by C squared. It's zero to a few dozen places of the decimal compared to the density. And if that's the case, you engineers in the audience will realize you now have a far simpler equation to solve, differential equation to solve. And some of you are nodding your heads a little too quickly. This is really a nonlinear equation, so it's not as easy as it looks. But the bottom line is this. You solve the equation, and it tells you that not only is the universe decelerating, it's expanding. Simultaneous positive expansion and negative acceleration. And that proves that God exists. You say, how can you make that leap? Well, okay, the 40 seconds are up. There goes the equation. Normally, I try to help audiences visualize this concept through a grenade. Because if the universe is simultaneously decelerating and positively expanding, that means it must be exploding. Now, I don't have a grenade here in front of me. I can only use it when I'm in California because they don't let you take such items on the airplane anymore. So you're just going to have to imagine that I've got a grenade here in front of me. But if I were to pull a pin from this imaginary grenade, then imaginary pieces would expand outward from the grenade. So there's the positive expansion. Stuff's moving away from the pin. But in a room like this, there are obstacles. And so those pieces inevitably will bump into various obstacles, and when they do, they slow down. So it's deceleration. And see, only explosions are described by simultaneous deceleration and positive expansion. And so this is where Einstein was able to draw the conclusion, the universe is exploding. But if it's exploding, that means it must have a beginning. Because just like with a grenade, you could measure the velocities and the accelerations of those pieces that are moving away from the pin. Then you could calculate how far back in time you have to go before all the pieces are together at the pin. But the significant point is this. What you've done through those calculations and measurements is that you've established there's a pin pulling for the grenade, or in the case of the universe, there's a pin pulling for the universe, which means there's a beginning to the explosion. And if there's a beginning, then through the principle of cause and effect, there must be a beginner, hence the existence of God. That's all it is. Now, that was beautiful theory. And Einstein was the first to admit, beautiful theory is not enough. You have to have observations. It took 12 years, but by 1929, an astronomer in Pasadena, California, proved that the galaxies are exploding away from one another, just as Einstein's equation of general relativity predicted. That was Edwin Hubble. 1930, Einstein looked at the data and said, yes, this proves that my equation is correct. This proves that the universe is exploding, and that therefore it has a beginning, hence a beginner, hence the existence of God. But by 1930, Einstein was kind of like Stephen Hawking today, world-famous scientist. And the fact that he made that statement was enough for all the newspapers around the world to pick up the headline about Einstein being convinced about the existence of God. And as Einstein describes in the book he wrote just before his death, this got him into a lot of trouble. Got him into trouble with rabbis and priests. You know, with a name like Einstein, he's got to be Jewish. But he's an interesting Jew, and he was educated in Roman Catholic schools. So he describes how in the years 1931 and 32, all these priests and rabbis came to congratulate him on his wonderful discovery. And his response was as follows. Not so fast in the congratulations. Yes, I believe God exists. Yes, I believe God is intelligent and creative, and that He created the universe. But I believe in the God of Spinoza. I deny the God of your Bible. And the priests and rabbis said, well, that's logically inconsistent, Albert. How can a being be intelligent and creative and not also personal? You know, they were right. There is no rebuttal to that. He would have to be personal if he had those first two characteristics. But Einstein dodged that in one of the following. Well, forget about that. I got one for you. If God is personal and all-powerful and all-loving like your Bible declares, then please explain to me why evil and suffering exist in the world. I'm grieved to tell you this. Now, one of those priests or rabbis answered his question. They basically said, we don't know. God knows. When you die, you'll find out. Now, I can tell you that's about the worst thing you can do with a secular rationalist, is to say, well, God knows the answer, and if you're just patient enough and wait till you're dead, you'll get the answer too. Have faith, brother. They don't think that way. They don't operate that way. And they didn't have to operate that way, those priests and rabbis. Because when you stack the Bible up against all the holy books of the religions of the world, what stands out, the Bible gives you a clear answer to the resolution of the problem of evil and suffering. Every other holy book ducks the issue. And see, those priests and rabbis were pretending that their faith was just like all the other faiths. You have to duck the issue. You don't. That's why included in your little set of handouts is a one-page outline, front and back, it's two pages actually, of the resolution of the problem of evil and suffering from the perspective of the Bible. In other words, if you go through about six chapters of the Bible, the first three and the last three, you'll see a resolution to the paradox of evil and suffering that you won't find in any other philosophy or any other holy book. And if you don't like that outline because of its brevity, you can purchase from our organization a 10 audio tape album that will do it some justice. And I just say that by way of response to, you want me to deal with the issue of evil and suffering? I can't give you a theological or philosophically satisfying answer in anything less than 90 minutes. There's so many issues that are raised that if I deal with one, it's going to force another issue to be dealt with. But I don't have to do that. And see, this is 1993. The problem with Einstein is, yes, he got mistreated by those clerics and was bitter towards them for the rest of his life as a result. But if he had lived to 1985, he would have seen a scientific answer to his question. And so, yes, if you want the theological answer, read the outline or get our tape album. But where I'm going to end up today is a scientific answer, or scientific proof for the personality, the love, and the care of the Creator. But Einstein died 30 years before the evidence came in. But today, we can use that evidence. But to his credit, to his dying day, Einstein held to the belief in God as the answer for the universe. Most of his peers did not. In my book, The Fingerprint of God, and we also covered in our video, I document 6 different attempts by my peers to try to do an end run around the God of the Bible. They really didn't say God doesn't exist, because the equation establishes some kind of God must exist. What they really were saying is, sure, God exists, but we don't need him to explain our existence. And we're going to develop an explanation for the universe that will allow us to keep him on the bench. So we don't need to bring him into the equation to explain why we exist. And in every single case, to make that happen, they had to lengthen the time back to the creation event. Because whatever illusions biologists had, the astronomers knew, if it's only 15 to 20 billion years, there's no way you can keep God out of the equation. That's only 10 of the 10 years. Many years ago, my peers in physics and astronomy worked out the calculation for what it would take under natural processes to make the simplest possible living thing a virus. You don't need 10 to the 10 years. You need at least 10 to the 100 billion years. That's 100 billion zeros after the 1. And the astronomers, their evidence was saying, all you got is 10 zeros. And I mention that because there's tremendous controversy today within the Christian community over whether the universe is 10,000 years old or whether it's 10 billion years old. Now, I happen to believe in the billions. If you believe the universe is real, you have to believe in the billions. In fact, if you believe that the Bible is the error-free word of God, you have to believe in the billions. My critique of the thousands of years is it leads to an inconsistency, New Testament versus Old Testament. But that's beside the point. My real appeal is this. Hey, my disagreement with Dwayne Gish and Henry Morris is only 6 zeros. That's trivial compared to the 100 billion zeros that separate both of us from the atheists. Why let a mere factor of a million get in the way of Christian fellowship? But see, the astronomers, knowing that, realized that they had to come up with a model for the universe that will allow for the 100 billion zeros. And basically, my book is a story about how, as we measured more and more about the universe, we realized there is no way we could make it that old. But the last attempt to make it that old, I'll skip all the other attempts and just focus on the last one, is what was called the oscillating universe model. And the reason I'm going to bring it up is as follows. Some of you are old enough to think back to the 1970s. What was going on in the 1970s? Our young people were rushing away from a Judeo-Christian worldview to a Hindu New Age view, and to a large extent that's still going on. Largely as a result of this model of the universe. This is a Hindu model of the universe. The Hindus 3,000 years ago said the universe is going through an infinite number of reincarnations, where the universe has a beginning, it expands, it collapses, rebounds into a next second stage of expansion, collapse, and as such the universe reincarnates an infinite number of times. The agnostics step in and say, well, if it reincarnates for an infinite number of times, then maybe we just happen to be on that lucky bounce of the universe in which atoms under natural processes assemble themselves into human beings. The astrophysical twist on it was to say, sure, the universe is exploding. But what stops or halts the explosion? It's decelerating. Remember I said it's decelerating? Well, with a grenade, what caused the deceleration? Collisions with material outside. In the case of the universe, it's not collisions. It's the masses of the objects that make up the universe. Remember your high school physics? Two massive objects will tend to attract one another. So if you've got lots of galaxies and quasars and other stuff in the universe, that attraction may become strong enough where it will take the steam out of the explosion of the universe. And so the universe would explode, but gravity would take the steam out. And once the explosion is stopped, gravity would take over and crush everything back down to a small volume. And this is where you have to appeal to something unknown. In fact, what you'll see in our book and our video is that every single attempt to bypass the God of the Bible was based on something unknown. Steady state model, there's an unknown force that does this. Then they found out no such force exists. In the case of the oscillating universe, they said there's an unknown bounce mechanism that will cause the whole universe to rebound after it collapses. So it expand, collapse, bounce, expand, collapse, bounce, etc. And that will make the universe old enough so that we'll have at least those 10 to the 100 billion years. But it doesn't work. The universe can't bounce for an infinite number of times. For the same reason, this ball cannot bounce for an infinite number of times. If I drop this ball towards this carpeted floor, it rebounded how high up off the floor? About 1/5 the height from which I dropped it, which means it has a mechanical bounce efficiency of 20%. And it's impossible in this universe to make anything with 100% efficiency, and that applies even to the entire universe. But more than that, for a long time, our physicists have been able to measure the bounce efficiency of the universe. We can do it through measuring the entropy. The entropy immediately translates. Entropy is an expression of how much of the energy of the universe is unavailable to perform work or unavailable to cause the system to rebound. Now, those of you that are engineers will recognize that any system with a bounce efficiency of less than 1% will not bounce. In other words, if I were dropping a wet lump of clay towards the carpet, would that wet lump of clay bounce? No. Its work efficiency is too small. Well, what my peers have known, literally for decades, is that the entire universe qualifies as the worst bouncing system in all existence. Its measured work efficiency is 1/100,000,000th of a percent, which means it falls 100 million times short of any possibility of rebounding, which is the basis for the title of this paper, The Impossibility of a Bouncing Universe. But it could have also been subtitled The Impossibility of Hinduism, Buddhism, and the New Age. Because every one of those Eastern faiths is based on the faulty concept that the universe can reincarnate. What this model, this research paper tells us, that it's impossible for the universe to reincarnate. Sure, it might have enough mass to collapse, but if it does, you've got one cycle only. One expansion, one collapse, and it's all over. Or if you lack the mass, you've got one expansion, and then it's all over. Now, what fueled Hinduism and the New Age in the 1970s was the recognition that the Hindus had come very close to predicting the cycle of oscillation. Because if you read into the Hindu Vedas, they predict that the universe oscillates, but they also put a number on it. They say it oscillates with a period of 4.5 billion years. And when I was at the University of Toronto, I roomed with 4 other graduate students. And they were all into various Hindu and New Age groups. I asked them why. They said, because of the oscillating universe model. He says, you're an astronomer. You know that if that model is correct, then the period between the bounces would be 20 to 30 billion years. The Hindus say 4.5. For them to get that close to the right answer within a factor of 6, Hinduism must be true. And so many people that had that education were persuaded to follow those beliefs and took a lot of people with them. But thanks to this paper and other papers, that can no longer take place. We can prove it's impossible. In fact, it's really fun to talk to Hindu audiences and give them the proof, scientific proof, that their worldview is incorrect and they need to adopt instead a Judeo-Christian view. Now, that Judeo-Christian view has been greatly strengthened as a result of another piece of research, this one done by none other than Stephen Hawking, along with Roger Penrose and George Ellis. What they did in 1970 was to take Einstein's equations of general relativity and not only solve them in the context of matter and energy, they solved them for space and time. See, those equations reveal a relationship amongst matter, energy, space, and time. Well, why didn't Einstein do it? The equations are too difficult. These three gentlemen took it the next step, and they produced the now famous space-time theorem of general relativity, which states that if the universe is governed by the equations of general relativity, then not only must there be an ultimate origin for the matter and energy in the universe, there must even be an ultimate origin for the dimensions of length, width, height, and time. As Einstein himself boasted, we proved that time was created. He didn't realize what he had done, what he was saying. You stack up all the holy books of the religions of the world. Only one claims that God is independently transcendent in creating the universe. Hinduism, time is eternal, God creates within time. Christianity, God creates time. Time is a beginning. God created time, and God was able to operate through cause and effect before the beginning of time. You know, I'm writing a book on this right now. What we discovered is that there are six different places in the Bible where God claims to put various effects into action before time even begins. Let me quote you a couple. The grace of God that we now experience was put into effect before the beginning of time, 2 Timothy 1:9. The hope that we have in Jesus Christ, Titus 1:2, was given to us before the beginning of time. Here's what's theologically important about that. Your friendly neighborhood physicist will tell you that time is defined as that realm or dimension in which cause and effect phenomena can take place. So what those verses are really telling us is the universe is confined to a single line of time, but God can move and operate in at least a plane of time. In fact, it's a little sharper than that. The universe is not confined to just a line of time, it's confined to half a line of time. Time can only move forward. Time can never stop, it can never reverse, it can only go forward. You want the simplest, most rigorous, and elegant proof for creation? Any entity confined to half a line of time must have a beginning, must be created. Since we can prove that the universe is confined to such a half timeline, it must be created. Since we can prove that the human race is confined to such a half timeline, ultimately we must be created. And that's really the basis for the child's question, if God created me, who created him? And the error that child is making is assuming that God is confined in time exactly as we are. But the Bible tells us he's not. General relativity now tells us that the Creator is not so confined. If God's operations can take place in a plane where you've got a length of time and a width of time, in this plane of time, you have the possibility of an infinite number of timelines in an infinite number of directions. So, for example, we could confine the whole universe to one line of time represented by the edge of this paper, which means it'd be possible for God to live in another timeline for infinite time, forwards and backwards in time, and that timeline would never touch ours. As such, he would have no beginning, no end. He would not be created. Colossians 1:16-17. He is no beginning, no end. He is not created. That theology is unique to the Bible. No other holy book preaches the independent transcendence of the Creator. So by that stroke alone, we've established that we've eliminated all possibilities but the God of the Bible. QED. The proof is there. Excuse me. Didn't know I was going to get quite that reaction. Now, before I move on to the evidence for the personality, the love, and the care of the Creator, let me share one other little bit of proof we can get out of this transcendence of the Creator. The thing that I recognize as a 17-year-old reading the Bible is unique amongst all holy books, in that it describes God's operations in the context of at least six dimensions of space and three dimensions of time. What about the other holy books? Every single one of them is four-dimensional, length, width, height, and time. God's interactions with his creation with mankind are in the context of just the four human dimensions we can experience. And one thing I was aware of in my late teens is this. There's a theorem of mathematics which states that no one can visualize phenomena in dimensions he cannot experience. So I took that as one additional proof that these other holy books were humanly crafted frauds and the Bible came from a superhuman source. The fact that the Vedas, the Quran, etc. all talk about God's operations in the context of just the four dimensions that we human beings can experience tells me that they betray the characteristics of human authorship. But the fact that the Bible speaks of these six dimensions of space and three dimensions of time, minimum, tells me it must come from a being that has the capacity to move and operate in those nine dimensions of space and time. So that book must come from a superhuman source. The rest of the books must come from a human source. Moreover, we recognize that the Bible is unique in preaching doctrines that demand extra dimensionality. You ever notice something? There is no Trinity in any other faith except the Christian faith. All the rest of them deny it. The Trinity is impossible in four dimensions. It makes perfect sense if you've got 11 dimensions. I say 11 because particle physics reveals a few more than what we get out of general relativity. That's another whole story. And the Bible speaks of nine. Nine's all you need, really, to make a Trinity work. Nine is all you need to have freedom of choice simultaneously true with predetermination. Notice every other religion, either they accept one and deny the other. They don't have both simultaneously true. You know, when I go on the campus, inevitably I run into Muslim apologists. They seem to have one in every campus now. And their response is as follows. We know your Christian faith must be wrong because the Trinity is a mathematical absurdity. Now, my first response is this. You're absolutely right if we're talking about a God that's confined to the same dimensions of the universe. Can you give me 10 minutes to share with you the latest proofs from particle physics and astrophysics that the Creator must be able to move and operate in 11 dimensions of space and time? Then we'll talk about the Trinity. Because when I deal with Muslims, you know, the Trinity is always the big barrier. You get nowhere until you get past that barrier. So I like to hit it head on right up front. And what's different about Muslims today is they're going to our good schools. They're learning to appreciate scientific rationalism. And so we can use that as a tool. Now, you say, how do you get the six dimensions of space? Well, remember that verse in the Bible where it says that the upper room, the disciples were gathered, the doors and windows were locked, and Jesus appeared amongst them. And those disciples, being excellent mathematicians, drew the conclusion, this cannot be the physical Jesus. Because they knew from their arithmetic training that three-dimensional physical objects don't penetrate three-dimensional physical barriers without something happening to one or both. But Jesus says, no, come forward and touch me. I am flesh and bone just like you. Then he ate bread and fish right there in front of him to prove his physicality. Then the disciples understood that they were dealing with a trans-dimensional being. Well, maybe they didn't get that far, but when I taught in this at Caltech, they immediately drew the conclusion. Because we're taught that in sophomore mathematics. How can you make it work? Okay, I've got a three-dimensional physical body here. If I got six dimensions of space, I can go through three-dimensional barriers. How so? Let's go back to this image of a plane. I'll use Hawking's paper again for that. You got a plane, length and width. But I can transform that plane of length and width into a line with a third dimension of space. Take that plane and you rotate it into the third dimension of space, and what do you got? Not a plane, but a line. The plane has become a line. If I have a fourth dimension of space, I can rotate the line, and the line now becomes a point. And so one way Jesus could get through that upper room and still retain his whole physicality is to take one dimension of his physical body, space dimension, rotate it from the first dimension of space into the fourth dimension of space, then take a second dimension of physical spatial capacity and rotate that from the second dimension to the fifth, the third to the sixth, go through the barrier and rotate back from the sixth to the third, the fifth to the second, and the fourth to the first. And you can also work out as an exercise how to make that happen in seven dimensions of space, five dimensions of space, eight dimensions of space. It's lots of fun. That's simply the easiest way, the one that I've just described. Now, what about the Trinity? Now, I can't show you what can happen in 11 dimensions in a way that you can visualize it. If you're willing to be satisfied with the algebraic equations and the geometry, then I can convince you this is true. But chances are you're not going to be too pleased with me if I do that. So what I'm going to do is use another tool. I'm going to take you from the four dimensions of length, width, height, and time down to three dimensions of time, length, and width. We're going to get rid of one dimension of space. And hopefully you can visualize thereby how the Trinity operates. Okay? Because I can't take you up to the 11 dimensions beyond merely giving you mathematical proof. If you want a visual picture, I can't do that. God's ways are above our ways. No man can think or imagine how wonderful the promises of the kingdom of heaven will be. Why? Because they're extra dimensional. But let's consider this handicapped couple, Mr. and Mrs. Flat. Now, I haven't got time to develop this as fully as I should, but that's one advantage of doing television. This is very hard to put in a book, but it's easy to do in front of a camera. I'm just going to give you a couple of minutes of it. Mr. and Mrs. Flat, and I'm going to put them in a universe that has only two spatial dimensions. So you can imagine here a plane called Flatland, and Mr. and Mrs. Flat exist in Flatland. So here they are in Flatland. I'm a three-dimensional being. Now, the Bible tells us that it's impossible for anyone to see God, and yet He is closer to us than we are to one another. See, as a three-dimensional being, I could put my hand 1/10 of a millimeter above Mr. and Mrs. Flat. I would be closer to each of them than they are to one another. Yet because I'm in a different dimension of space, they can't see me, they can't touch me. That's how the Bible describes our relationship with God. He's closer to us than we are to one another, yet we can't see Him or touch Him. Now, the only way they're going to be able to see me is if I come into their dimensional frame. Now, there's no way I can take all of my physicality in three dimensions and show them that in two dimensions. I have to give them a cross-section. For example, I could go to Mr. Flat and put one finger through the plane. What would Mr. Flat see? He would see a short line, and if we went to the trouble of walking around my finger, he would see that, no, it's not a line, it's a circle. But he would run home and tell his wife all about it, excitedly talking about this revelation he had seen from extra dimensions, and he would draw the conclusion that Hugh Ross is one small circle. But the next day, I could go to Mrs. Flat, and instead of poking one finger through the plane, I poke three fingers through the plane. And she'd rush home and tell her husband, "My dear, you are wrong. I too have had a revelation, but you are wrong. God is not one small circle. He's three small circles." And they could have a theological argument that would run on for hours, weeks, months. The end result would be that Mr. Flat would insist on going to the church of the one circle, whereas Mrs. Flat would go to the church of the three circles, which is exactly what people have done outside of the Christian faith. They have said that God is singular or that God is plural. Whereas the Bible says, no, we're talking about a being that is simultaneously singular and plural. And there's no way that's going to work in four dimensions. But if you've got 11 dimensions, no problem at all. Anyway, you can get her video for some descriptions of that, but it helps us to appreciate a verse that Bruce will be sharing with you tonight. John 16. The disciples were grieved that Jesus was going to leave. Yet his response for him was, it was far better for you that I leave than I remain. Why? Philippians chapter 2. Jesus left the power and authority and extra-dimensional capacities he shared with God the Father, humbled himself, and came into our lower realm of four dimensions. And he lived that way for 33, 34, 35 years. But at the end of it all, what did he do? Through his death and resurrection, he once again took up the authority, the position, the power, the extra-dimensional capacities he shared with the Creator from the beginning. And basically what he was telling his disciples was this: I'll be able to do far more for you when I leave than what I could ever do when I was here on earth. And I want you to appreciate that. And what we have today far transcends what the disciples had available to him, to them, before the day of Pentecost. Okay, we can pursue that into evil and suffering, free will, predestination. That's basically what a lot of our materials do. And sometimes you've got to do that for the secular rationalists. The first three questions that you get, the top three objections you get from secular rationalists is as follows. I don't believe God exists. That's the most frequent objection we get. The second most frequent one is this. Okay, I believe God exists, but I don't believe it's the God of the Bible. The third most frequent is as follows. Okay, I believe it's the God of the Bible, but I see no resolution to how an all-powerful, all-loving God can tolerate the expression of evil and suffering. God can't be personal. And that's where this extra-dimensional material can be of great persuasion for showing them how that is a reasonable explanation for free will, predestination, eternal security, evil, and suffering. But there's another way we can get a handle on this. We have measured the universe. In measuring the universe, we can measure the characteristics of the Creator. Now, this field of study was actually launched shortly before the universe was measured by John Wheeler. And he simply pointed out that the forces of physics are all extremely fine-tuned. Now, I'm only going to share one. What he said was as follows. The strong nuclear force governs the degree to which protons and neutrons stick together in the nucleus. If that force is too strong, every proton and neutron in the universe would find a partner. In such a universe, there would be no bachelor protons. You say, what's the problem? A bachelor proton is the element hydrogen. No hydrogen, no possible life. Not just life as we know it, but no possibility of life whatsoever. On the other hand, if the universe has a strong nuclear force that's slightly weaker, all the protons and neutrons will be bachelors. The force won't be strong enough for any of them to stick together, which means the universe will have nothing but hydrogen within it. And again, life will be impossible. You have to have carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, etc. And how sensitive of a parameter are we talking about here? It's so sensitive that if you were to change that strong nuclear force by 2%, up or down, it'd be impossible for the universe ever to support life. So as small a change as 2% makes it impossible. Now, we've been able to measure the universe. We know how fast it's expanding. The universe expands too quickly. What happens? The material blows apart so quickly that galaxies will never form. No galaxies, no stars, no stars, no planets, no planets, no life. But if it expands more slowly, the galaxies will form, but they'll form so efficiently that they'll very quickly collapse themselves into black holes. And again, no stars, no planets, no life. How sensitive is that parameter? It's sensitive to within 1 part in 10 to the 55. change it by one part in 10 to the 55, no life would ever be possible. That number is hard to visualize. Let me give you a tool. I have a ballpoint pen here. Okay, I sharpen up on its point, and I'm going to put it on top of this podium here, and I'm going to so delicately balance this in a vertical fashion that when I let go, it remains standing on its point. And I do that with 50,000 ballpoint pens simultaneously, and none of them fall over. The universe is more delicately balanced than that balance on just this one parameter. Now, how many parameters are we talking about? Hard to take it down to the whole list. 20 of them. There are 20 separate characteristics of the universe that we can measure today. Every one of them is delicately balanced. Now, this is a piece of evidence that none of my peers will dispute. Now, I've written a book on this subject. Several chapters deal with this evidence for design, but I haven't written the only book. There are 8 other books you can purchase on this subject, all published by non-Christians. And yet you stack up all 9 books together, what every one of them say? As we observe the universe, we see in the universe the characteristics of exquisite design for the benefit of mankind. They all say that. No one disputes that. What does that tell you? The only explanation for that exquisite design of the universe for the benefit of mankind is that God is personal. Because only a personal being can craft to that degree, can design to that degree. But let me give you an example where we can push it even beyond the mere conclusion of personality. Remember I told you at the beginning of my testimony? God can't be personal because look how big the universe is, 100 billion trillion stars. What we now know is that the size of the universe, the mass of the universe, governs the efficiency of nuclear fusion. And if you make the mass of the universe too large, the fusion will work so efficiently that the universe quickly converts all of its mass into elements heavier than iron. And in such a universe, there's no carbon, no oxygen, no nitrogen. Life is impossible. But if the universe is slightly less massive, then the fusion will not work efficiently enough. And the only elements that will ever form in the history of the universe would be hydrogen and helium. And again, you'd be missing those elements essential for life. What does that tell you? For God so loved the human race that he went to the expense of building 100 billion trillion stars. And he carefully shaped and crafted those 100 billion trillion stars for billions of years so at this brief moment in time, we could all have a nice place to live. See, that doesn't tell us that God is just personal in his ability to design to an exquisite degree. It also tells us that he cares for us, that he loves us. And see, even the age is a proper parameter. If the universe is too young, no life. If it's too old, no life. You know, people ask me, why did God do it now? Because the way he designed the physics of the universe, life is only possible at a very narrow window of time. And we're in that window of time right now. Now, I'm not going to go into this, but I could do the same thing for the solar system. Only in the case of the solar system, we have 44 parameters, not just 20 parameters. So when Carl Sagan speaks about the universe being filled with all these planets that could support intelligent life and how we should spend the $100 million, actually that got voted, we already are spending the $100 million and wasting hours and hours of valuable telescope time looking for this non-existent intelligent life. And you say, Hugh, how come such a harsh conclusion? It's harsh in the sense that Carl Sagan has not updated his conclusion. He launched this whole study back in 1963, in which he said you can't have intelligent life unless you have a G5 type star and you've got a rocky planet orbiting that G5 type star 93 million miles out. 2 parameters. There are 42 other parameters that also must be fine-tuned for life to exist. Based on his 2 parameters, you eliminate all possible planets except 1 in 10 million. But if you add up the other 42 parameters, you eliminate all possible planets except 1 out of a trillion, trillion, trillion. Now, the universe only has 100 billion trillion stars. So that means there's less than 1 chance in 10 trillion that you'll find even one with a capacity to support intelligent life, and that's assuming you've got as many planets as you have stars. And that's a grossly optimistic estimate. And so it's a waste of time to look for this intelligent life. Senator Proxmire phrased it this way, and he was only looking at 8 parameters, not the full 44. Based on 8 parameters, he said, we shouldn't be spending money looking for intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. We should spend that money to look for intelligent life in Washington. Now, let me close with this. What I've been doing for you is taking you from the simple to the complex. We started with mathematics, we went to astronomy, we went to physics, we went to chemistry, and to biochemistry. I could keep going. I could talk about the fossil record. I could talk about the exquisite design of the cell, of the chromosomes, of the DNA, the RNA, and the proteins. And what you see is you go from the simple to the complex, the evidence mounts. It's not 20 parameters, it's 44 parameters, and millions of parameters. But the problem with the most complex, namely the human species, is now you can't see the forest because of the trees. And the greater the complexity, the less we know in terms of being able to make a definite statement. Let me just finish up with the other end of the stage. But my argument is basically this. If we've got all this hard proof in those sciences where things are very simple, how much more do we expect exponentially the proof to grow when we move to areas of study where things are orders of magnitude more complicated? And people say, well, how come the biologists don't see this? They can't see the forest because of the trees, and the data they have has got very large error bars compared to what is typical in physics and astronomy. Things are less fuzzy, or things are more fuzzy. But when you talk about creation and evolution, people love to debate the most complex issue. And see, I've purposely avoided that. But if you want to talk about what's most complicated, what I would share with you is this. Eliminate everything that is speculative and stick to that which is most definite. And the case of the origin of man, we don't know a whole lot. We don't know a lot biblically. We don't know a lot scientifically. There's only one thing we can compare, and that's a particular date. Now, you know the story. You've got the so-called evolution of man, where you begin with this primitive hominid creature here, and it evolves step by step up to this advanced species here. None of you are going to be watching the Super Bowl, right? Now, when you get at the Bible, what does it say? Well, it speaks about advanced land mammals in terms of the tameable animals, meaning the large land quadrupeds that can't be tameable, and the rodents. It says nothing about bipedal primates. Nothing at all. They existed. Lots of things existed that the Bible is silent about. It says nothing about dinosaurs, says nothing about insects or amphibians. And sometimes people complain about the fact that the Bible says so little about such important species. Actually, I see it as testimony of the grace of God. If he had told us about all 500 million species that he had specially created, we would have had to pack 38 volumes minimum to church every Sunday morning. He was gracious. He condensed it to one page. And in terms of the bipedal primates, utterly silent. Now, what it does say is the following. It tells us that God rested when he created the first and only spirit species on planet Earth. See, he created three kinds of animals according to Genesis 1. He created animals with bodily material only, matter only. That's the first bara. He created the physical universe, brand new out of nothing. The second time you see the Hebrew word to create brand new out of nothing, the soulless creatures, the birds and the mammals, body and soul. The last time you see this for the human race, body, soul, and spirit. We were created in the image of God. Now our body and soul, it was a miracle of God. It uses the word asa. We were manufactured personally by God. But in addition to the personal manufacture, something totally brand new is placed within our being, the Spirit. And when God created Adam and Eve, He stopped creating. You know, people misinterpret the fossil record. The fossil record, as time goes on, more and more species, greater and greater diversity, greater and greater complexity. But it doesn't stop there. Once you got man in the scene, it reverses. Now, as time goes on, we got fewer and fewer species, less and less diversity, less and less complexity. How come? It's the natural process of all life forms to decay and to go extinct. The only reason that was different in the fossil record era is God was at work creating new species of life to replace those that decayed and went extinct. What do we see today? God's not at work in creating new species of life. So all we see are the natural processes. God is at rest. He is still at rest. Live your lives so that you will enter God's seventh day of rest. That's why I'm convinced the days of creation are long periods of time, not six consecutive 24 hours. There is no Hebrew word for a long time period. The only possibility is to use the word yom. For 6 days He created, and the seventh day He rested, and that gives us an answer for the enigma of the fossil record. But in terms of the human species, we can ask the secular anthropologist this. What's the most ancient evidence that you can give us for the spirit capacity of any species? Well, when was the first time we saw religious relics, temples, altars? 8,000 to 24,000 years ago is the most ancient evidence we have for anything that could be described as spiritual. What's the date that the Bible gives for the creation of Adam and Eve? Somewhere between 6,000 and 60,000 years ago. We know the genealogies aren't complete. Compare the genealogies, that's obvious. But we know they're not totally incomplete either. So roughly 6,000 to 60,000 years ago. The 6,000 to 60,000 agrees with the 8,000 to 24,000. The Bible says the same thing as a scientific record. And I submit to you, that's the way it is for everything in terms of creation, evolution, science, faith, and the Bible. What have the secular rationalists been taught? They've been taught that the Bible and science are totally at odds and completely contradictory. What is the real state of affairs? Exactly the opposite. Science is not the enemy of the Christian faith. It's a friend that God has given us to prove to people in these last days that there is only one way. There is only one God. It is Jesus Christ. Now I'll just leave this up as we spend the remainder of our time in discussion. Revelation 3:8. God promised us that before the Lord would return, He would throw open a door for us that no one could close. And I think we're seeing that open door. You know, no matter where we go in the world, when you begin to develop these new evidences, people recognize we're seeing something we can't contradict. When I address departments of physics, kind of giving the same talk I just gave you here, I say, what do you guys think? Inevitably they say, we cannot deny what you're saying is true. And if that's the case, your only rational response is to give control of your life to Jesus Christ. There's no other possibility. What can you do with this stuff? Hey, if you want to be trained as a hotliner to answer mail, answer the phones, we can do that long distance for you. Want to be able to just be trained to deal with people in your neighborhood or at work? We'll be willing to help you. How can you pray for us? I'm the only full-time researcher. But you know what? We got people all over the country, all over the world that are ready and willing to do what we're doing. I'm amazed at how many scholars are evangelicals. We had 3 biologists on our television program from Caltech, from 3 different research groups. First biologist said, my group, 50% Christian. Second biologist said, good, it's only 1/3 Christian. Last guy got up and said, mine's the worst group in campus, it's only 25%. The reason I had them share that in our television program, the average guy out there, the average secular rationalist, believes it's 1 in 1,000,000 amongst research scientists, especially amongst evolutionary biologists. 1 in 1,000,000. What's the truth of the matter? The statistics are higher at a place like Caltech
in the research biology departments than they are for the population at large. And I think it's high time that we recognize that, begin to welcome these people in our churches, and begin to use them in a way that we can be better equipped to share our Christian faith with others, and really see a paradigm shift where people recognize that God has given us the evidence. There's no basis for rejecting it other than our own human hearts. Jeremiah 17:9. So, if you'd like resources, give us a call, write us. And one thing I'd like to encourage you to do, you've got a book list there. And you notice in that book list we gave you, about half the resources are resources written by non-Christians. What makes this evidence so powerful is that we can use the research material, the books written by the non-Christians, to establish we're dealing with the God of the Bible. As I mentioned, 9 books just on this one subject, the measuring of the universe. All say a creator must exist. He must transcend space and time, matter and energy, and he must be personal in the way he crafted the universe for our benefit. You'll never see them use the word Jesus Christ, but they define all the parameters that makes that the only possible conclusion. So please give us a call. We'd love to help you. Any comments, any questions at the back? My scriptural basis for the Big Bang would begin with Genesis 1:1, though that's not this most specific verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It's Shamayin Aretz for heavens and earth in the Hebrew. And when those words are hooked together in the Hebrew, it can only refer to the entire physical universe. The word bara means to create something brand new, literally out of nothing. Hebrews 11:3 expands that. The universe that we can detect was made from that which we cannot detect. So that means it must transcend that realm in which we can make measurements, namely length, width, height, time, matter, and energy. And you heard me quote 2 Timothy 1:9, Titus 1:2. We can go on. We can provide you with a scripture list. You'll find it in the book here, and it's in our tape materials on the scriptural support for the idea of a transcendent creation event, which is really what the Big Bang is all about. There's a moment back in time where we see this transcendent creation event where all matter, energy, length, width, height, and time come into existence. What the Bible will add is this. There's a moment in the future when all that will be converted back into nothingness. Out of nothing it was created, back into nothing it will go, and God will replace this universe with a brand new universe. So that's where the physics stops and the theology takes over. And if you want a fun exercise, read Revelation 21 and discover the new laws of physics that will exist in the new creation. Right.
I think we get an idea that God has created 7 days for our use, right? For our daily use. I'm not asking for an answer here. Are you saying, in your belief, God could not have done that in 1 day? In 4 hours?
God could have done it in 6 nanoseconds, 6 microseconds, 6 days, 6 years, or 6 trillion years.
But you're saying he didn't really mean when he said it was light today, there's 24 hours.
Let me frame this for you. The text, first of all, does not say that God created light on the first day. The Hebrew word there is the word hayah, let there be. It's quite different from the word bara, to create brand new, or the word asa, to manufacture. As I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, you need to follow this scientific method which came out of the Bible. First, identify the point of view. The Spirit of God was on the surface of the waters. It was dark on the surface of the waters because the light that God created couldn't penetrate the atmosphere to the surface of the waters. The miracle that God performed in the first creation day was to transform the opaque atmosphere into a translucent atmosphere where light from the sun, the moon, and the stars could pass through the clouds. Now, the clouds never broke. It was permanently overcast. But now, for the first time, the observer could tell that there was day and night. He could detect that the earth was rotating. Before that, he would have no basis for determining that. It was permanently dark. Now you have 12-hour cycles of daylight and darkness. And yes, he called that one day. But you need to understand this. The Hebrew word yom, translated day, has four possible definitions. It can mean 12 hours like day and night. It can mean 24 hours like one solar day. It can mean several years like the day of the Lord. Or it can mean an open-ended number of years of much longer time span, which means one must examine the context to see which of those definitions is applied for which point. Now, what's interesting is as you go through Genesis 1, you get three possible out of those four possible definitions in use. Now, you see one right there in the first creation day. The first definition of 12 hours is used. But when you work your way down to Genesis 2:4, it uses the word day to refer to the entire creation week. Obviously, it's a longer period than 24 hours. And what do you discover for the seventh day? The pattern of the evening and the morning, day X, is missing. Now, why is it missing? You discover that the Hebrew words for evening and morning likewise can mean beginning and ending. And one thing that's helpful is this. You need to understand that the Hebrew language has much fewer nouns than English. As I mentioned, there is no noun in biblical Hebrew for a long time period. Whereas in English, we got many. Age, era, epoch, and there are others. But in biblical Hebrew, you got none. Your only option is the word day to describe a long time period. Likewise, in terms of certain adjectives and nouns like evening and morning, those Hebrew words will do double or triple duty. Now, Hebrew is the opposite way in terms of the verbs. The Hebrew language is very rich in verbs, and typically when you translate from Hebrew into English, you don't get that. You know, people read Genesis 1 and they're not aware of the fact that you've got all these subtle details wrapped up in the words that pertain to God's creative activities. And so you miss things. And so that's the key to really getting the depth of Genesis 1, is to study all the verbs. But given that evening and morning can mean beginning and ending, the first creation day has a beginning and ending. The second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, the seventh. It doesn't. He is resting. He is still resting. The reason there is no evening and morning, dash, day seventh, is the seventh day is not yet finished. We're still in God's seventh day of rest. And if we're in God's seventh day of rest, that means the first 6 days likewise must be long time periods. And see, what I'm applying here is two rules of interpretation. It must be literal, and it must be consistent. You know, where did this sixth consecutive creation day interpretation came from? The King James translation, where people forgot about the consistency rule and focused on the literal rule. And you'll see a particular error in the King James translation with respect to the evening and morning. It's different from the other translations on that one verse. What it will say is the evening and the morning were the first day. The evening and the morning were the second day. You quoted it very close to the original Hebrew. There was evening and there was morning, dash, day, second, day, third, etc. That's really what the literal Hebrew says. I'm just saying that the King James translators, in the case of that one verse, oversimplified the translation. They said, let's make this more readable. But in making it more readable, they communicated a slightly different meaning as it pertains to the time scale that God chose to create.
Do you see any reason why God used billions of years each day for this creation?
Yes, I do. You want to get our material on evil and suffering. I think that will help. Because what does Romans 8:22 point out? The entire creation groans, waiting for the adoption of sons. It's not just the last few thousand years in which humanity has existed. We're talking about the whole of creation, all of space and time. And what do you discover when you read Revelation 21? As soon as God conquers the problem of evil and suffering, He gets rid of the universe and replaces it with a brand new one. What does that tell me? It means that the entire universe was specially created by God so that He could quickly conquer the problem of evil and suffering. And so when you ask the question, God, why are the laws of physics the way they are? Why are the constants of physics the way they are? Why these billions of years? Why this 100 billion trillion stars? The bottom line answer is this, that God specially crafted the universe, knowing ahead of time that there would be a Satan, that there would be a Garden of Eden, and that there would be a fall. But He'd already built into the constants and equations of physics those capacities, thereby once Adam and Eve fell in the Garden of Eden, He'd be able to quickly use their physical environment to conquer the problem of evil in just a few thousand years. And what's a few thousand compared to all eternity? I stand amazed at how quickly God is dealing with this. We only have to live for 70 years here. And the creation only has to suffer for a few thousand years, and it's all over, and we go into a brand new universe, new laws of physics. Read Revelation 21. It's wonderful. It's fantastic. Well, as King David said, if God is gracious, He will give you 80 or 90. But the limit is this, He will never give you more than 120. Genesis 6, that's the maximum limit, and indeed that is borne out in birth certificate and death certificate records. That's the ultimate limit on our lifespan. So God bless you. May you make it close to that 120. Okay. Yeah, that question often comes up from one segment of the Christian community, and that's the appearance of age idea. I see that as scientifically incorrect and biblically incorrect for the following reason. It's not that God created Adam with maturity, it's that He created Adam with capacity. Size and capacity, ability to function, are not reliable indicators of age. You know, a lot of us have had children. You can see that in our children. We have two boys. One is about 6 inches taller than what he should be for his age. The other one is about just right. And if you look at our oldest boy, you might conclude a different age for him than would otherwise be correct. So size is not a reliable indicator. Neither is functionality, what an individual can do. What would be a reliable indicator would be the spread of liver spots on the skin. That's quite a reliable indicator of the age of a human being. cholesterol in your blood is another indicator. Scar tissue, chipped teeth, gray hair, etc. We can talk about that. Now, when it comes to Adam, it's all speculation. You know, when God created Adam, what kind of age did He measure to be? Well, nobody was there to check it out. So it's all speculation. On the other hand, the universe is still here. The earth is still here. We can measure it and check it out. And the reason why I would make the dogmatic statement that God must have created Adam brand new without any appearance of age, because it tells us in many places in the Bible, Psalm 19 is a good example, that the record of nature is a reliable indicator of what God did. In other words, God does not create with the intent to deceive. He creates with the intent to reveal. If the universe is young, it will measure to be young. If it's old, it will measure to be old. After all, we're all without excuse because God has revealed himself through the record of nature. And it's impossible for God to lie. 8 times the Bible tells us that God cannot lie. That's why I believe that the 66 books of the Bible are error-free. God has told us that it's impossible for him to lie. And as I study the Bible, it has the characteristics of it being it doesn't lie. There's no contradictions. There's no deception. But the Bible also declares that the same thing is true of the record of nature. And, you know, people talk about the record of nature and the special revelation and say, wait a minute. You're claiming that I trust the record of nature more than I trust the Bible. I says, that's not the way it is. Truth can never contradict truth. You know, that's like saying that I trust the book of Romans more than I trust the book of Hebrews. I don't trust either one of them more than the other. I believe that both are God's revelation. Both are truth and nothing but truth. I believe that also applies to the record of nature. God can't reveal anything deceptive or untruthful. And so when the astronomers measure the universe and they see that it's very big, I think you can believe them. It really is very big. And if it's very big, it must be very old. Size translates into age just because of the light travel time. That light really did take billions of years to reach us. But I think you can see the problem. And you go to the secular rationalists and you say, my Bible teaches that the universe doesn't exist, that it's all a mirage. If that secular rationalist has any education in astronomy, he will say, you're just like those Roman Catholics who refused to look through Galileo's telescope. And since that's the way it is, I don't want to go to church. And really what I think we need today, if you look at church history, Christians have always placed stumbling blocks in front of unbelievers that have nothing to do with salvation. You know, Acts 15, we want them all to be circumcised. What has circumcision got to do with salvation? Nothing. Therefore, it shouldn't be in your doctrinal statement. What has the age of the universe got to do with salvation? Nothing. Therefore, don't put it in your doctrinal statement. What has the extent of the flood got to do with salvation? Nothing. Therefore, don't put it in your doctrinal statement. And don't go to the unbeliever and say you must believe in this fashion of communion in order to be part of the body of Christ. Does the Bible say that? If it doesn't, don't use that as a stumbling block. And as the church back in Acts 15 pointed out, hey, we ourselves can't overcome this stumbling block. If we can't handle the stumbling block, we have no business of putting it in front of the unbelievers. And that's a lot of what we have to do in Reasons to Believe, is say, Christians, we got a lot of secular rationalists out here that want to join your church. What we need to do is make sure there isn't such an extreme cultural barrier that they can't go. And that's why I think it's most important that Christians begin to reach out to these people so they discover what they're like, so that they begin to culturally adapt to make it possible for them to enter. And by the way, that's not unique to us. When we went over to Russia and began to talk to research scientists there, we would take them to these Baptist churches. You know what they would say? We can't go here. We can't bring our friends here. The cultural barrier is too great. It's not just us. It exists all over the world.
Thank you, Hugh. Let's bring the formal meeting to an end.